Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, a look at how police found the suspect in the case of the slain Princeton jogger. Also today, remembering Joe Crowley, one of the first survivors of clergy sexual abuse to come forward in Boston.
The message to others, especially those who haven't come forward or haven't really dealt with it, is you can survive and you can live a happy, good life.
And what happens now to the tens of thousands of drug tests falsified by Annie Ducan? Plus, should kindness be a factor in college admissions?
Good grades aren't enough. I need to do things. I need to volunteer. I need to work for charity. I need to help the blind, the orphans. I don't know. I just need to do something.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. Today we learn more in the case of Vanessa Marcotte. She's the 27-year-old who was attacked and killed while jogging on a rural road in Princeton 8 months ago. Marcotte had been visiting her family from New York City and was found less than a half mile from her mother's house. Last Friday, law enforcement arrested Angelo Colon Ortiz in his Worcester apartment, and today he pleaded not guilty to assault and rape charges, with a bail set at $10 million. WBUR's Bruce Gellerman was at the arraignment this morning, and he joins us now. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Tanya.
So he was charged with assault and rape, but not murder.
Yeah, that was my question, actually. And it turns out that the DA, Jeffrey Trevors, says that he will be charged with murder, just not now. They're going to convene a grand jury, and that'll take about a month, and then they'll file the charges after an indictment.
A lot of people were anticipating this court hearing today. What did you learn in the court today?
Oh, there was a lot of new information, actually. A lot of small details, but they seem, according to the DA, to point to the direction of Colon Ortiz. So, for example, we found out that her cell phone was turned off at 2:11. She was supposed to be going out that afternoon to Boston to catch a bus back to New York City, where she was living and working for Google. And she never came back. So when she was missing, her parents called the police. They set out a search and they found her body about 8:30 that night. She apparently put up a fight, Tanya, because under her fingernails, we learned this today, under her fingernails, there was DNA allegedly from her attacker. And police set up a hotline. They got about 1,300 phone calls, tips from people. And one eyewitness apparently saw a dark Ford Explorer parked in the area. In fact, he saw them twice that day. Mm-hmm. And he also saw a Hispanic-looking man next to it. And so police have been looking for the man in the vehicle ever since. And then last Friday, we learned that a state police detective in Worcester spotted a man driving a vehicle like that, looking like that. And he ran the plate. And then he went to the apartment of Angelo Colon Ortiz. He went there, in fact, twice, and the second time arrested him.
This is an interesting part of the story because this officer just happened to be in the area, right?
Yeah.
And he saw this SUV pass by.
That's what we're led to believe.
Okay.
He saw a dark SUV and a Hispanic man driving it.
Right. He captured the license plate.
And actually, he wrote it on. He didn't even have a piece of paper. He wrote it on the palm of his hand. And so police say they've got Ortiz, and that Ortiz voluntarily gave them a DNA sample. And they compared it to that, DNA that was found under Vanessa Marcotte's fingernails. And, well, here's Worcester DA Jeff Travers.
That swab came back with a confirmatory match, suggesting that a similar match, the likelihood would be 1 in 108.3 quadrillion.
Now wow. Tanya, yeah, wow. Put this in perspective. That's 108.2 followed by 18 zeros. So Travers says the possibility of a mismatch is just beyond remote.
So we've been hearing a lot over the weekend about, a lot of speculation around Colon Ortiz. What do you know about him? What can you tell us about him?
We found out he was born in Puerto Rico. He's 31 years old. He's a U.S. citizen. He doesn't speak English, and he came here a year ago. He soon got a job after he arrived in Massachusetts driving for FedEx. And the prosecutor says his route took him near Princeton on occasion. That's about all we know. He didn't come out. We didn't see him in court. He was hiding. He was not hiding. He was behind a wall, and he did not come out into the courtroom proper.
So authorities say there is this remote chance, like this DNA is unequivocal, that this is the guy, they're saying.
Right. The gold standard.
Yes. There are a lot of questions, though, around the collection of the DNA evidence. Especially since we now learn that he doesn't know English.
That's right. And you should be actually the defense attorney if they're asking those type of questions, because his defense attorney, Ed Ryan, wants to know exactly the same thing.
One of the things we're going to look at very carefully is whether or not he knowingly, voluntarily understood what he was being asked to do, and whether or not he knowingly and voluntarily gave up a sample of his saliva in a buccal swab.
Okay, so what happens now?
Well, as you said in the introduction, he's being held on $10 million cash bail, which is a $100 million surety bond. So he's not going anywhere. He's staying in jail. And next month, there's going to be a status hearing, and we'll probably learn a lot more about the evidence that prosecutors say they haven't collected.
Well, thank you so much for this update. A lot of people over the last few months have been following this and holding authorities to this, wanting to make certain that there was someone found.
Yeah, they've been searching 8 months flat out. You hear the prosecutor talk about the search. They have been working night and day on this case.
WBUR's reporter Bruce Gellerman. You can see more of his reporting on the case on our website, radioboston.org. Thank you, Bruce.
You're welcome.
I was still like a kid with all this resentment and anger and rage and self-pity, and it just owned me. And through a series of things, hard work, and people that were there for me in so many areas, so many ways, I learned how to be a survivor.
That's the voice of Joe Crowley speaking to the Boston Globe after the release of the movie Spotlight about the paper's investigation in the Catholic Church's cover-up of sex abuse by clergy. Crowley passed away on Easter Sunday at age 58. He was one of the first survivors of clergy sex abuse to come forward, and he paved the way for so many victims of abuse to speak out. Sasha Pfeiffer wrote a moving tribute in the Boston Globe today about her first meeting with Joe. She wrote that he was, quote, smart, funny, and articulate, but also nervous, insecure, and still trying to recover emotionally from what had happened to him decades earlier. Joe's brave story touched so many. One of those people was Jim Scanlon, himself a survivor of clergy sex abuse. He got to know Joe Crowley during a premiere of Spotlight, and he joins us now. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Tanya.
So tell me, how are you doing?
I'm emotionally exhausted. I got a call yesterday from Sasha Pfeiffer telling me what had happened to Joe, and it was a real punch in the gut. It was a surprise, and I was with him a few weeks ago, and he seemed to be doing pretty well.
I wanted to ask you about that. Tell me just a little bit about how you all met and you kept in touch all of these years.
Yeah. Back before the movie came out, back in October of 2015, the director and writer of Spotlight put together a private screening for some of the victims, and three of us, as a matter of fact, Phil Saviano, myself, and Joe. At that time, I was and am in the movie anonymous. There's a different name used for me, and I was very, very private about what had happened. I had never met Joe or Phil, but after the movie, we all went to dinner, and I explained my situation, and there was a connection for me, especially with Joe.
Tell us a bit about that connection. That connection really led you to really speaking about what happened to you.
Oh, he was probably the most impactful person on my decision to be public with my story. When I got to see him, everybody has handled this differently, people who are survivors. But Joe was a very positive man. He used humor to hide some of his pain. And I saw how he was handling it, and I saw how easily and comfortable he was talking about what happened, and it was a light bulb for me. Seeing the movie and seeing it all together, but then watching Joe and saying, you know, why the hell am I shameful about this? What do I have to be ashamed of? And it just turned a light bulb for me and turned a corner for me that when the Providence Journal reached out to me to do the story, I said, you know what? Joe has had a positive impact on me. I want to let other people know, other survivors know, that you don't have to stay in the shadows.
Tell me about the last time you saw him and the time that you all spent together.
Well, it's classic Joe. I'd been talking with him, and, you know, it was late March, and we had just had the snowstorm and that, and he was getting claustrophobic and hadn't been out a lot. He'd walk a lot, but he certainly didn't drive, and so I invited him to this we were packing meals for needy kids in Rhode Island. It's an organization that I'm part of. So we were going to spend the morning. I said, hey, you want to take a ride with me to Rhode Island, to Providence, and help feed some hungry kids? And he said, sure. Joe wasn't necessarily an early riser, and I told him, we got to get out of here, get out of Boston by 7:30. But he happily did it. And we went down and spent about 4 hours doing that. We went and grabbed lunch afterwards and just spent the whole day together. Mm-hmm. That's the funniest part. It's his attitude that day kind of swung to positive again, and after kind of just being, you know, snowed in. And his health seemed better than prior times I had seen him. You know, I'd had a lunch in January with him, and he seemed to be doing good. And that's why it was such a shock when I heard he had passed.
One thing in Sasha Pfeiffer's piece today that struck me, and I'm sure so many people who read it, was about Joe's health issues and how really over time it was symbolic for the pain that he had gone through. When you read that, or when you thought about that, when you think about Joe and you think about what you've gone through and so many of the survivors, what is it that you want people to remember most specifically about Joe?
Well, I mean, even with those health issues, he battled through so many things, and she did. She spoke about him being brave. To me, he was the most resilient person I knew. He and I would go for coffee and would just talk, and the things that man went through, how he survived those years and the years where he abused alcohol and abused himself, and his health was not good, but something happened and his resilience kicked in, and he was sober 20 years. And the message to others, especially those who haven't come forward or haven't really dealt with it, is you can survive and you can live a happy, good life. And yep, his early years beat him up physically, but it didn't get to him mentally. He was a strong, positive person.
There was one thing that Joe said in a documentary a few years ago. He said, what I learned is that every voice counts, and one of them is mine. And you spoke to that just now about how it was Joe that really made you feel that your voice was important and really to be come out of the shadows to let people know your name. Talk about why it's so important that people not only share their stories but share their names and really take that step of bravery.
Because it, one by one, it helps everyone. And I know I went from feeling shame and trying to forgive myself to feeling proud that I could survive and proud that I am enjoying a very good life. And that day Joe and I spent together, I'm glad I told him this, but I was just telling him because I meant it, but because he helped me to come forward. It's probably close to 70 people after my story got out there in the paper. A number of people who were close friends, business acquaintances, people I didn't know have reached out to me, and they're starting to tell this story that they're getting help. One neighbor who was a woman who had been abused by a step-parent hadn't told her husband or her family, and she's getting help. She's told her husband and just feeling great about or better about who she is. She's working hard at it. And that's Joe's legacy. that's one by one. And because she's sharing it, someone else will come forward to her and get the help they need and turn things around or make things better. And I'm glad I told him.
I'm glad you told him too. Thank you so much for talking with us. And our hearts go out to you and all of those who knew and loved Joe Crowley. That's Jim Scanlon, a friend of Joe Crowley and a survivor of clergy sex abuse. Jim, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Tanya. It's an honor to speak on Joe's behalf.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. Well, it is college admission season, and that means anxious high school students are searching for any edge that will help them stand out. And here's one pop culture example, Rory Gilmore from The Gilmore Girls.
Good grades aren't enough. I need to do things. I need to volunteer. I need to work for charity. I need to help the blind, the orphans. I don't know. I just need to do something.
But amidst all of the SAT scores, grades, internships, letters of recommendation, summer programs, extracurricular activities, resumes, AP tests, and personal essays, some admissions officers say something is still missing from college applications, and that would be kindness. That's what Rebecca Sapke argues in her most recent New York Times piece, Check This Box If You're a Good Person. Rebecca was director of international admissions at Dartmouth and now has an application reader. She's now an application reader for them. And she joins me from her home in Norwich, Vermont. Rebecca, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
So listeners, we also want you to hear from you. If you have a thought about this, we also want to hear what you think about this idea of kindness as we go through this discussion. So I want to start by asking you, Rebecca, in your essay, you talk about this letter of recommendation that really struck you. You wrote that, quote, it was the most surprising indication of kindness you had ever come across in your admissions career. You've got to tell us more about this, that student, that letter, and why the application stood out to you.
Sure. So I've been doing this for a while. I've been working in admissions for 15 years, and we receive a lot of letters of recommendation. The common application, which is the most common, as it's called, application in the United States, requires two teacher recommendations and a guidance counselor recommendation from every applicant. A couple years ago, however, we received an additional letter of recommendation from a custodian for a particular young man who was applying to Dartmouth. And it really struck me as unusual for many reasons. Number one, he talked about the student's thoughtfulness when nobody was watching. And I think, in college admissions these days, we get a lot of recommendations from people in positions of power or wealth or fame. Some students will send additional recommendations from people that they think can influence their applications because, you know, they're celebrities. However, this letter of recommendation was from the school janitor who had watched a young man pick up trash in the hallways, turn off lights in empty rooms, and learn the names of the entire custodial staff at that particular high school. And it was something I'd never seen before, and it was something that really excited me.
What's really interesting to me, though, when I read that part of your essay, I thought, but this guy just sounds exceptional. I mean, he's going and turning off lights and knowing all of the janitor's names. Really, you know, I just read off all of the list of all of the things that students think about when they're applying to college. Do you feel like this idea, though, of having kindness be a factor where folks are thinking about what others are thinking of them as they're walking through life might also be a burden?
I think that kindness is important in college admissions, and I think right now there's no way for us to, you know, quantify or qualify how a student treats another student in the classroom. However, how you treat people who can do nothing for you is critical. And I think, you know, I think the college admissions process is cutthroat. And I'd like to think that you can be smart and kind, and you should be smart and kind. And I think, you know, for this particular custodian, to write this letter, I believe it was unprompted. We have no way of proving that, but I believe that this letter was unprompted. I think this custodial staff member wrote to us because he wanted to speak for this particular student. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if it becomes a burden, I think it's a good burden to have. I think if you know, high school students start treating each other with respect and dignity, you know, when no one else is watching and not just for credit, that'd be a good thing.
So, listeners, I forgot to give you guys the number. It's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let us know, do you think that kindness should be measured? And really, I want to ask you, I want to ask you, Rebecca, how do you measure kindness? Of course, you received in this application a janitor who wrote these kind things about a young person. But what are some ways that we'd be able to measure kindness?
That's the great question. And that's the question I hope that educators, you know, across the globe are trying to answer. You know, in college admissions, it's very difficult to measure kindness, but I think people are working on it. For example, at Dartmouth, we have a supplemental essay question. It's a prompt that literally says three things in human life are important. Is a quote from Henry James. The first is to be kind, the second is to be kind, and the third is to be kind. And so we asked students to share a moment when kindness guided their actions. The Dean of Admissions, Lee Coffin at Dartmouth, thought this would be a nice kind of supplemental, optional question to ask of students. I think that, you know, I think that lots of admissions officers are trying to, you know, find ways to make relationships with guidance counselors and teachers to let them feel honest and in a confidential environment to really share what they feel about students. You know, are the students getting an A just to get an A and maybe at the expense of, you know, maybe some other students in class? Or is it a student who goes out of his way to help the other student, you know, study for a test and so they both do well? It's a really tough thing to measure, but it's something that I hope people at least are thinking about and working towards.
We actually have a caller, Emily, from Acton, and she's a little bit of a cynic about it. Emily?
Well, I think that my first question is just, who had the idea of including a letter from a custodian? I think there are a lot of kids that are incredibly kind oftentimes, and also we all make mistakes. But when you're in the admissions process, you have to balance your kindness and your humility with your ambition. And this just makes me wonder, did the student ask the custodian for the letter? Because the student's generally the one who submits the letter of recommendation, which I found incredibly awkward when I was asking teachers to say good things about me.
Mm-hmm. Emily brings up a really good question, Rebecca. Was this prompted? And how is that when you're asking people, hey, will you write a letter about how kind I am?
Yeah, absolutely. And as I mentioned before, we don't know if they're prompted or not. Unfortunately, there's no way for us to tell. But just, you know, in reading the letter, it really felt like this custodian was doing something. He had worked there for a really long time. I think he genuinely wanted to help this young man. And I don't know. Who knows what the truth is.
But Emily also brings up the idea of young people growing into who they are. So she talked about how many young people are kind, or they're growing into kindness. What do you say to the idea, though, that college is part of fostering the person? And so maybe as people go into the application process, they may not be as kind as they will be when they leave college. That's kind of the purpose of college, is to kind of form who you are and who you will become.
Yep, and I agree with that, of course. You know, you're going to college to learn, and you're learning how to become a person as well, a kind person. But, you know, I do think, and I do agree that many, many students out there are kind. I'm very grateful for my job because I feel good about the world each and every day because I read applications from the most talented, impressive young people who are going to make a difference in this world. Yeah. And yet I just think, you know, if we're measuring SAT, you know, if we're looking at SAT scores and we're measuring grades and we're, you know, we're looking at all of these other things, you know, kindness would be a great thing to at least have admissions committees considering when they're reading these applications. And perhaps, you know, the letter from the senator who clearly doesn't know the student but is just writing it because he feels like he has to, because maybe some, you know, a student's father or a student's relative asked him for the letter, you know, that doesn't hold as much clout as a letter from somebody who perhaps, you know, the student doesn't think can, quote-unquote, do anything for them in the admissions process, but in reality, they can show us a side of a student that we're not already seeing in the application.
Right, in their academics. And we have a teacher on the line, Mary from Andover. She's asked to write recommendations all the time. Mary.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I just want to thank your guest and thank you for having this topic on your show today. I teach in a very high-stakes school district, and our students start stressing in their freshman year, and they're so busy trying to pad their resumes that they don't stop and take time to even think about kindness. It's not that they are innately unkind. They're just laser focused on got to get into college, and I think it's unhealthy for them. And this idea of including kindness is a wonderful reminder. So thank you very much, and I hope more schools adopt this practice.
Rebecca, she speaks to a lot of what you've said, and you also talk about having folks who know you and maybe deepening those letters. You talked about the power of the anecdote. Can you talk more about that?
Yes, absolutely. And I want to thank Mary for writing those recommendations, because we know how hard it is for folks to write recommendations. And we know that many, many teachers and administrators write a lot of letters of recommendations. And sometimes the best letters just tell a story. They don't have to be long. They don't have to use superlative, you know, language. But if they can tell us a story about a particular student in a particular instance in a classroom, sometimes that paints a picture more than, you know, the letter that goes on and uses all the superlative adjectives.
Yeah. Ryan from Haverhill, he says, kindness has been lacking in schools. Ryan, are you there?
I sure am. Thank you for taking my call.
So you say it's really going back to the schools themselves and kindness within the schools.
Well, to a certain degree, yes, but I think that the college application process sort of accidentally fosters this egocentric approach where it's, you know, me, this is, and the way, you know, you would apply for a school is, this is what I do, this is who I am. But I think kindness is, unfortunately, we don't have a metric for it yet, but I think it's very important because it's about me and how kind I am, but it speaks more about, you know, what you're willing to do for others who, like you said, have nothing to offer you in return. I work with adults with developmental delays, and it's been a very humbling experience. And I just feel like if more people could open their eyes to the degree of kindness and how substantial it is, they could see how effective it could be. And I just I think this is a great idea. I hope to see it explode in the future.
Thanks for that, Ryan. Ryan brings up another really interesting point. There was just last year the Harvard Graduate School of Education surveyed 20,000 students, and what they found was that most of them ranked being a caring person below academic achievement. So really what Ryan was saying is, do you think that current college admissions really fosters that idea of my academics and less about kindness? And how can they change that?
Yeah, unfortunately it does. I mean, it's a competitive process, and whenever you have competition, you create a system that is making people, you know, try to outdo the other. The kindness metric is very, very difficult. But I do think, you know, we will find a creative way to at least hopefully not allow students who are, you know, taking advances at the expense of others to kind of get into these elite colleges. And I don't have the answer, and that's why I wrote the essay. I don't have the answer. But I do think sometimes, you know, I'd rather read an essay from a student who writes about how they treat other people than an essay about a student who just goes on and on about how she is treated, right? I'd rather, you know, get to know what is the motivation here for this particular student. Are they motivated because they want the Ivy League degree, or are they motivated because they want to help others? You know, it's difficult, but you know, the college admissions process is not making this any better.
And you say you don't have the answers, but many colleges, including Dartmouth, is actually taking this as a as a step to say, when we measure kids, when we're looking at all of these applications, let's define some ways that we can ask specific questions that get to the heart of whether you're kind or empathetic. Correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. And you know, that Dartmouth supplemental question is a perfect example of this. And I think even behind the scenes, you know, it's funny, I worked at an institution before Dartmouth where the woman at the front desk, the receptionist, she would keep notes if a student treated their parents poorly on a tour.
Ooh.
and it never, you know, it was never an official part of the application, but if there was a student who really was not kind, you know, to their family on the tour, it was something that was there if we were interested in using it. And so I do think as, you know, the college admission process also becomes more competitive, we're going to have to get to the point that we're going to be looking at other factors. You know, when everyone has perfect SAT scores, you have to go to something else, right? Mm. And when everyone has perfect grades, you've got to go to something else. And so hopefully these intangible personal qualities will start to seep through the college admissions process and help us make better decisions.
Okay, so we have Jill from Wellesley on the line. She says she's cynical about it all, though. Jill, are you there?
Hi, yes, and I think it's interesting, you know, this whole, just what she just said about having to have perfect SAT scores and perfect, when everyone has perfect SAT scores and everyone has perfect grades, you need to look for something else. And I think this just goes to the whole idea of these colleges looking for exceptionality from kids. And, you know, this idea that now they have to be exceptionally kind, they have to be have exceptionally good grades, exceptionally good test scores. And I think what's being lost in this whole process is just finding a good kid. Mm. You know, it's not the exceptional kid, but the good kid. And what we're finding from these graduates from these Ivy League schools is that actually this exceptionalism is really a problem in this day and age. And so, you know, I'd like to hear what they have to say on this whole idea of exceptionalism. And I just feel like now they're adding kindness to this idea of having to be exceptional.
Thank you for that, Jill. What do you say to that, Rebecca? That what about choosing a holistic kid and maybe them not being perfect all across the board and that pressure to be perfect?
Absolutely. And I don't want to paint the picture that students have to be perfect. There is no perfect student. But the reality is, you know, and I, to be fair, you know, I'm speaking from someone who reads applications at Dartmouth, where mm-hmm. our admit rate is around 10%. It's incredibly competitive. I tell people I didn't get in there, which I actually find, you know, interesting. I work there, I choose these students, and I got denied from this institution many, many years ago.
And you're so competing against some places where the acceptance rate is 5%.
Exactly. And it's crazy. It is absolutely crazy. But it is competitive. And so I don't have the answers, but I do think that, you know, the kindness piece of this, that custodian recommendation, when you have a student who goes out of their way to help others and it's coming through the application in through different lenses that makes it feel, you know, real. It really helps the student's candidacy.
I'd love to know what's been the reaction to your op-ed piece from colleges, from students, from staff, faculty.
Yeah. It has been overwhelming. I have received emails from, everyone. I've received emails from students. I've received students emails from, I've received students, sorry, emails from a custodian. I received emails from the heads of schools. I've been in newsletters. The piece really went viral, and mostly good. Of course, there are plenty of cynics out there, but I do think it has helped foster the conversation, and lots of people are thinking about this. I don't want to make it seem like this is just solely my idea. I read an application. I wanted to talk about a custodian recommendation because in my career, it has been the one thing that really stuck with me. It was such a unique piece of an application that I really felt like I needed to say something about it. But there are lots of people talking about this, and I think I really struck a nerve with this New York Times piece. It went viral, and I think it's because a lot of people have strong feelings about college admissions these days.
And we have so many people who are on the line. We have time for one more call. It's from Yvonne from Brighton. And Yvonne, you feel conflicted by this.
Yes, I do. Hi, everybody. I just want to say that I do think this is a great idea, and I would have loved to have this 10 years ago when I was applying to college. But at what point does it become artificial? because if you're being graded on kindness, then it kind of becomes like how people will feed homeless people, but then put it on YouTube so people will say, oh, how great they are. Mm-hmm. How do you decipher what is real and what is not?
Rebecca, thank you so much, Yvonne. That's a great question. At a certain point, you even wrote about this in your article that now probably next year you'll be receiving tons of recommendations from janitors. When does it become like something that people are doing specifically for the purpose of college?
Yeah, and I did write about it in my piece. You know, we've been saying in my admissions office, you know, we're preparing for all the custodial recommendations next year, and I laugh just because I think that if nothing else, if this piece makes students realize that being a kind person to other human beings, and you know what, even if it's to get them into college, if they're paying a little bit more attention to the person who's cleaning their toilet, that's A-okay with me. And I just think in a crazy world right now, a little bit of kindness goes a long way for college admissions or for not college admissions. And so that's why I wrote the piece.
Well, thank you so much, Rebecca, for joining us and talking a bit more about your piece. That's Rebecca Sapke. Thank you so much. She's former director of international admissions at Dartmouth College, and her piece in the New York Times is Check This Box If You're a Good Person. You can link to it at our website, radioboston.org. Rebecca, thanks again for joining us. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Coming up, prosecutors dismiss thousands of cases potentially tainted by former state drug chemist Annie Dukun. I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. Thousands of cases potentially tainted by former state chemist Annie Dukun could be dismissed. During the 9 years Dukun worked for the state, she falsified tens of thousands of drug tests, either making up results for samples she never tested or manipulating the samples in order to ensure they tested positive for drugs. Dukun served 3 years in prison and was released on parole last year, but the fallout over those cases continues. WBUR's Deborah Becker has been covering this story since all of this came to light in 2012, and she's at the John Adams Courthouse with more. Hi, Deb.
Hi there, Tanya.
So right now we're looking at a tally. How many were dismissed today?
Well, it's still trickling in. Have until end of business day today, which is essentially 4:30 this afternoon when this courthouse closes. This is the courthouse housing the state Supreme Judicial Court. So what the prosecutors have to do is file by 4:30 today the number of cases they intend to dismiss. So they've identified thus far about 24,000 potentially tainted cases, and they've indicated that more than 23,000 will be dismissed. A couple of the totals that we've gotten so far at the courthouse today are Essex County. They're going to re-prosecute about 55 cases out of 4,200. Mm. Bristol County, 112 cases. Suffolk County, 117. The Cape and Islands, one case remains for re-prosecution. So it does look like it will fall into the maybe 600 or 700 cases left to re-prosecute, meaning that more than 23,000 will be dismissed.
I know it's really early, but do you have any idea the measure by which they chose these specific cases to re-prosecute versus those to dismiss?
Well, this is not for a long time. We should say there have been several cases that have been brought to the state Supreme Judicial Court, which is why this is the place where all of this is being filed today. The State Public Defender Office, the American Civil Liberties Union, and others have filed suit saying that these convictions should be dismissed because the evidence was potentially tainted. The problem went on with Annie Dukun at the State Drug Lab for a decade. And they really don't have a hand on how many cases and what was happening there. They asked in this latest legal action brought by the ACLU, the court asked the prosecutors to identify cases based on this tainted evidence.
You are breaking up, Deborah. I am so sorry. Can you continue to talk? Let's see if we can hear you because you're saying such important things. Yeah. I'll cut you off when I can't hear you anymore. I'm so sorry, Deborah. I am so sorry. We're having, you know how it is with cell phones, right? But we do have in the studio to talk a little bit more about these cases, our WBUR legal analyst and retired federal judge, Nancy Gertner. Hi, Nancy. Good to see you.
Hi.
So we heard a little bit from Deb Becker about the process and what's happening today, and we'll learn a little bit more as time goes on. The ACLU had a news conference also to talk about these cases, and they're pushing for all of the cases to be thrown out. I'd love to know from you, first off, what's your reaction to what you've been hearing so far, the decision from some of those jurisdictions to throw out some and to retry others?
Well, there are two ways that they could have proceeded, and one way was to say, when a bedrock of the government's case is tainted in the way these cases were, that they should be dismissed. That was the so-called global remedy. If anyone pled guilty or went to trial based on a Ducan certificate of drug, you know, what the drug consisted of, that it should be dismissed. The next round was, no, these cases should not be dismissed if there was independent evidence that suggested that the drugs were either what she said they were or that the drugs were illegal and also independent evidence of quantity. So essentially what the prosecutors have been doing is going through the list to see if there's independent evidence, if they could prove what she sought to prove through other means. And that's the reason. That's the reason why it's been winnowed down like this. I imagine that in the cases that have been dismissed, there was no other way to prove it other than a Ducan certificate.
I also want to bring in, we have on the line former federal prosecutor Brian Kelly. He is the partner of the firm Nixon Peabody. Hi, Mr. Kelly. Welcome.
Hi, how are you? Hi, Judge Gertner.
How are you? Hi.
So I'd like to know from you as well, what's your reaction to what you've been hearing? We should hear more by the end of the day today. But I know that you've kind of had some other thoughts around this.
Well, I think my first reaction is, wow, this is a staggering number of cases that are being dismissed. And, you know, it's for good reason. If the chemist can't be relied upon to say something is a drug and it's a drug prosecution, the prosecution's hands are tied and they have to dismiss all these cases. But it's really incredible the number of convictions that are now being thrown out. And it has all sorts of collateral consequences as well. Now someone who may have been a felon up until today and couldn't possess a weapon now can go out and get a weapon if he's no longer a felon.
Well, I want to back up a little bit. So you say in both cases, you say it's staggering, but then you also say that if it was tainted, then it's something that has to be looked at. So can you really elaborate a little bit more on the distinction that you're making there?
Well, I don't think it's a distinction. I think it's staggering because of government misconduct. The chemist, she ruined 23,000 convictions, and it's appropriate that those convictions not stand if the main witness to the issue of whether it's a drug or not was corrupt. And so it's staggering to the extent that her bad conduct has had such ramifications. I'm not faulting the prosecutors. Their hands are tied. I think under the law they should dismiss them if they can't prove it independently, like Judge Gertner suggested. If there are confessions, if there are other ways to show these things were drugs and the amounts can be proven, then that's what the state apparently intends to do with a handful of probably what they deem to be the worst offenders.
Judge Gertner, Mr. Kelly brings up the point of dangerous criminals now being possibly released. What's your reaction to that? Do you have any concerns about these folks potentially being released and being a harm to the public?
Well, we obviously have concerns about that. But, you know, the system depends upon the integrity of the chemist and the integrity of the prosecutors and the defense lawyers. If that integrity is undermined, then the society has to take the risk of the release of these individuals. It was something years and years ago that a Supreme Court justice said that, you know, this is the dismissal takes place if the constable has erred in a substantial way. When you're talking about the drug chemist here, you're talking about the centerpiece of a drug case. And so while it's troubling and, you know, but it's troubling, there's no question about it. If we don't take these actions, then we're allowing corruption to continue. And that happens all the time, that someone could be exonerated because the evidence was not kept in the way that it should. Something wasn't tested appropriately. The search was illegal. These are the things that we do in order to keep the integrity of the system intact. And I think we have to follow through on that.
You said in an op-ed piece you wrote a few years ago, quote, how many defendants pleaded guilty to a more serious offense because the drug laboratory results about quantity or drug type seemed insurmountable? Can you elaborate a little bit more on this? So we're talking about potentially dangerous folks. We're talking about people who may be low-level drug offenders or higher-level drug offenders, and the processes by which we come to a conviction. You touched on it a bit about how important these drug tests are in coming up with this, but talk a little bit more about that other stuff that happens, which we don't know in every case here, whether or not that's the case.
Well, so the system is distorted not just by the, you know, what you see on television, which is the innocent person pleading guilty or the innocent person being convicted. This also could be someone who was who in fact had been involved in something low level, who pled guilty to a more substantial charge because his lawyer came in and said, this is what the evidence showed. And so he pleads guilty to X rather than Y. Then there are people who may have, again, pled guilty to what they had done, but they were doing it because they didn't think there was any basis to challenge it in court. Mm-hmm. And the court challenges are not minor in our system. Court challenges to illegally obtained evidence, to tainted evidence, are part and parcel of the system. So if someone pled guilty because the lawyer said, you don't have a case, buddy, and it turned out it rested solely on Ducan, then that person should be able to set aside the plea.
Mr. Kelly, what do you say to that, Judge Gertner?
He always agrees with me.
you always agree. That really, the system is what's flawed here, and this really illuminates a larger issue around the system.
Well, look, I don't think we can conclude that there are 23,000 innocent people in this case. You have 23,000 people who were unfairly convicted with a corrupt chemist. Many of them may well be guilty. So I don't think it's a situation where 23,000 people got railroaded on drug prosecutions. At the end of the day, it's a serious crime what she did, and that's why she spent time in prison. And not only did she suffer the consequences, now society and the system are suffering the consequences, because this is no small task for these state prosecutors to have to go through all these cases and figure out which, if any, can be salvaged. So it's a huge manpower issue for the prosecution's offices to undertake, but unfortunately they had to, because their star witness in many of these cases was lying or making things up, and you can't have that.
It's a huge undertaking, and also a lot of money and resources. Do these jurisdictions, does the state, do we really have enough funding to really investigate these to the scope that's needed? I mean, now we're talking about potentially taking on an already overbloated system.
Well, I mean, I think that's what the SJC, the Supreme Judicial Court, came to that conclusion. I mean, initially it said anybody who pled guilty or was convicted on the strength of a Ducan certificate could move to set aside the plea. And then we were going to look, the court suggested, at each case to see if they would have gone to trial without the evidence. That turned out to be an incredibly difficult case-by-case approach.
That's right.
And the public defender said that they could not go there because they didn't have the resources. And so the court, the second time around, or the third time, whatever it was, said that let the prosecutors determine whether or not they even have colorable basis to proceed without her testimony. And that wasn't this, everybody's being dismissed. You have to look at it case by case, but still let the prosecutors winnow it down so that we don't go through the ceremony of review when there was no content to it. But, you know, we have a system in which when someone is acquitted, when someone is found not guilty, it's that the evidence wasn't sufficient. Mm-hmm. They may well have been sufficient to meet the standards of mm-hmm. our Bill of Rights. They may well have been guilty, but we say not guilty if their evidence doesn't meet that standard. In a certain sense, that's what we're saying now. The evidence doesn't meet the standard of integrity that we require of our process, so these people should not be charged. And Brian is quite right. In that pot, there could be the innocent, which I doubt. There's some in that pot. It's not very many. But it's certainly there are people who are convicted based on tainted evidence, and that we have to pay attention to.
There's so much more to talk about here. We're just the tip of the iceberg, really, and we'll be learning more as the evening rolls on and the days go on as well. But I thank you both, WBUR legal analyst Nancy Gertner and Brian Kelly, former federal prosecutor. Thank you both for taking this time to talk with Radio Boston.
Glad to do it.
Thank you.
Take care.
And this is Radio Boston. Thanks for coming into our show today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station.